Welcome to Fresh Off the Set. I'm Carrie Hawker-Diaz.
And I'm Brooke Mangum. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode. Now, Carrie, you're a mom, right?
Yep, and it's hard.
Yeah, last time you checked, still a mom?
Yeah.
Same. Does your daughter ask you questions that you don't know how to answer?
Yes. You want to know the most recent one?
Yes.
What are nipples for, Mom?
Okay. There you go. Well,
I mean, you don't want to lie to them. I don't even remember what I said, but like, I wanted to make it calm and not awkward and, you know.
Right, because you do want to educate them because like they're going to, like, and if you don't answer the question, then they ask somebody else. And it's like, I'd much rather be the person that answers these awkward questions. But
yes. Are you getting that from your little girl too?
I am in the strongest why phase. It's just everything like has a why. If, like, we're watching a show, why? She's recently started asking me like, what happens when you die? And I'm over here going like, you know, well, honestly, I don't know. I'm not entirely certain.
I mean, that's the truth.
I have my beliefs. You can make yours, but it's so hard. And I know that my daughter's 4. How old is Amelia?
She's 7. Just turned 7.
The topics are just going to get harder.
Well, it is. And I feel like every child is different at every age, obviously. So some kids who are 10 can handle differently than like kids who are 15 even. You know, like every child emotionally is at a different level. So how do you know what to answer and when? And
I'm convinced I'm still emotionally like 12 to 13. How do you feel like
you're about age 11?
11, right in there.
Yeah.
But don't you wish there was an expert that could help you as a parent, guiding you with the right things to say?
Yes, I do. And actually, Alora spoke to Dr. Kristen Francis about those hard topics. Should we take a listen?
Let's take a listen. Get your pen handy, people.
Hello, hello. I am sitting here. Well, I wish I was sitting here with her. I am talking to Kristen Francis, who is board certified in both adult and child and adolescent psychiatry. This is going to be an amazing interview full of so many things that we need to learn about mental health. Kristen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I am so excited to chat with you. And I was going to say we, but it's just me talking, but everyone listening, I'm sure, is going to be so excited about this podcast. We are tackling so many topics that have to do with mental health. But before we get to that, give us an overview of kind of who you are and what you do for work.
Yeah, so I'm a child and adolescent specialty psychiatrist. I'm board certified also in adults, and I see adults. But my real specialty is in child and adolescent development, treatment. I typically work with the most severely ill patients, the ones that are needing to be hospitalized or are having, you know, emergencies, urgent situations.
Okay, so, and we're going to hit, like I said, this podcast is going to be jam-packed full of information. We are going to hit a bunch of different topics with you. But first, let's just start with mental health, because this topic, I mean, when I was growing up, no one really talked about it. It was taboo for so many years, and now we're starting to get more open about it, which I am so appreciative of as someone who suffers from anxiety. What are the most common mental health issues that you see?
Yeah, so typically, you know, whenever we start talking about mental health, it's really important to talk about it as brain health. You know, the brain has really been like one of the last organs to be discovered and talked about, described, and we're still really new in it. So there's a lot we don't know, but what we do know is that major depressive disorder, which has a really specific definition, anxiety disorder, those are very concrete, episodic, meaning just for a time period, disorders or conditions that occur in someone's brain. And it really changes the way we think and feel, and often how we act. And so it would be similar to being diagnosed with like diabetes type 2 or, you know, like a lung infection, but it just shows up differently.
Mm-hmm. And I love that you said that. I remember just, you know, on a personal note, when I was diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, I remember feeling so, I felt so embarrassed and I shouldn't have been. Mm-hmm. And I remember I had a great support system and my mom was like, well, if someone broke their arm and they got help for that, or they had diabetes and they got help for that, or they had a heart issue and they got help for that, would you think less of them? And I was like, I would never. That is, why would anyone do that? And then she was like, why would you think less of yourself for being diagnosed with this?
That's exactly the attitude we're looking for. That's exactly the attitude that is you know, challenging stigma, because that is what is preventing people from getting support. And we know with any brain health condition, early intervention is key. So the sooner we can diagnose, the better it's going to be in terms of outcomes, the shorter the severity, the shorter the duration. So it's really important. So among kids, we see a lot of, you know, over the past 5 years, we've seen a big increase in rates of depression, mm-hmm. as well as anxiety disorders. Suicidal ideation, especially in young kids, is really increasing as well. More visits to the emergency department, mm-hmm. you know, death by suicide is the leading cause of death for children here in the state of Utah, which is really unique because typically you would see accidents as mm-hmm. the first cause of death for this age group. But in Utah, unfortunately, we're seeing it death by suicide, which is totally something that we can support and treat and prevent. So mm-hmm. it's great that we're talking about it.
Absolutely. And I mean, that is just honestly, it just, and I don't say this lightly, when you give those statistics, I get really teary-eyed and my heart just hurts because it is, you want to help these kids, and that's what we're talking about today. So let's talk about a couple of these specific, maybe just different things that are going on in their brain so parents can help. And even if you're not a parent, if you have a child in your life, you can see these symptoms and you can help them. Let's start with bipolar disorder. What are some of the symptoms of that versus, you know, normal development that parents, caretakers, family members, friends can be on the lookout for?
I love this because a lot of parents see their youth, their child, their adolescent switching moods frequently throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And they come to us and they often say, I think my child is manic depressive. They're bipolar. You know, they're up 1 minute, they're down. And that is a really helpful thing to start talking about because that is typical for adolescents. That is typical for young people. If we think about their ability to regulate their feelings, it's really low. It's something they need to be coached in. Their brains are fully developed. And so it's really normal for kids to have radical mood shifts moment to moment or from a trigger, like you said, a limit. You have a different change. Class, a friend upsets you. That's different than bipolar disorder, which is a very specific definition of, you know, at least 5 days or more of an inability to stay asleep. And you feel good. In fact, you feel better than normal without that sleep. Maybe behavior is changing. But the important part to note is it's really that way all the time in that period of days. So it's not up and down during the day. That's more just normal adolescent development.
Oh, interesting. Okay, that's a lot I didn't know because I've heard parents say, you know, my child is up and down, up and down. And like you said, that's kind of normal for a kid, but it's those other symptoms that you have to watch out for. So if you watch out for those other symptoms, you find out that your child is bipolar, what kinds of treatments are available for this disorder?
Yeah, so we have great treatments for youth with bipolar. They show that the studies all show that lithium, which is an old medication, it's actually natural, it's a salt. So it's been around for a long time, but we really found that it's the most effective medication for preventing mania, those up periods of time, which can either look like, you know, giddiness, happiness, or irritability, constant irritability. Mm-hmm. And then also preventing depression. So in bipolar, you have both mania or up periods, and then those severe depressive periods. Mm-hmm. In between, you might go back to your normal baseline, or maybe you don't. Maybe you just go right from mania to depression. The biggest thing is that we prevent the mania because mm-hmm. depression always follows.
Yes. Okay. That I'm going to probably say this too many times during the podcast. That is something that I'm not aware of, which is so great that we're talking to you about that, because I think so many people in their minds, they have an idea of what these disorders are, but they may not have the full picture. So this is so good to know. So if someone has this, how does it affect them in their day-to-day life, and how can parents best parent a child who is bipolar?
So bipolar disorder is one of the more serious mental health conditions you can be diagnosed with. So, mm-hmm. you know, something that will be happening throughout their life. The best thing is to be on a medication and to stay on the medication. But if someone's in the middle of like a manic episode, a hallmark of it is that they won't really understand that they're acting differently. They're doing great and they will feel really well and they'll be really productive until they're not. And so until their bodies start to kind of shut down because they're not sleeping or they're moving too much and not nourishing themselves. So it's really typical for someone in an episode to not be aware and to deny a need for treatment. And in fact, they often don't want treatment because it feels really good at first. And so that's helpful for parents to know. And also when someone's really depressed, their depression's really severe. It's hard for them to get out of bed. It's hard for them to motivate. They're going to be, you know, feeling really down, hopeless, helpless, suicidal. So those are all characteristics that parents should expect and anticipate if their child's in the middle of one of those episodes.
Okay, that's good to know. And so we've touched on bipolar disease. I mean, we only touched on it, but now I want to talk about, I grew up dancing and I saw this type of disorder that we're talking about next all the time. Let's talk about eating disorders. What is an eating disorder versus disordered eating?
Yes, this is one of my favorite areas. I'm really passionate about treating patients with disordered eating or eating disorders. So anytime in psychiatry we call something, you know, a specific disorder, it means it's causing impairment or trouble in a lot of areas of someone's life. So at home, school, it can't just be in one situation. It's interfering with friends, their normal responsibilities, function, work. So if someone is suffering from an eating disorder, they're going to have impairment in all of those areas. And, you know, eating disorders have just been increasing as well, unfortunately. New guidelines are that we should screen every single person who comes into a psychiatric visit for an eating disorder because they're so much more common now. Oh, now, disordered eating can lead to an eating disorder, but it just really means that, you know, you're starting to have some pickiness, some changes in the way you're eating. Binge eating disorder, so eating a lot of food in one setting past the fullness feeling and then feeling really guilty about it. Mm-hmm. That's common disordered eating that can progress to an eating disorder. But what we see a lot in Utah is young people wanting to be super healthy. That isn't normal. That's not typical. So that should be a warning sign. Your young child, your early adolescent shouldn't be focused on how they're healthfully eating.
That is so interesting. I think of personal experiences when we talk about this. I feel like social media is playing a big part in that. And I know that's not exactly what we're talking about today, but I remember I was following a fitness plan and there was a girl who was around 18 that had sent this fitness instructor a question that was like, I need to know how to eat healthy and doing all this stuff. And the fitness instructor was like, don't buy my program. I need you to stop focusing about this. And it's just so interesting to me that this has become a thing with young kids. Because when I was younger, I didn't even think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been a real push within, you know, most aspects of our society to help kids, quote, be healthy because of our fear of, you know, bigger bodies. And there's just a lot of interesting discussion to be had there. But the biggest thing I really want parents to be aware of is if your child's eating habits change, you're their parent. You know what they've eaten like their whole life. And if they're starting to eat less, if they're wanting to eat by themselves, if they're getting really focused on cooking for everyone but not eating it, or if you're noticing large amounts of food being gone, or you're seeing your child quickly go to the bathroom after a meal, those are all things that I want you to start having some curiosity about and having a conversation.
Absolutely. So now we know what to look for, but how can parents, you know, caregivers, families help their kids avoid or overcome these eating disorders?
Right. There's some really good information from science out there about this question. The number one thing that parents can do is to not talk about bodies, not talk about body size or shape. This is really hard, okay? Even as someone who's trained and specializes in this area, I have to fight to remember. I can't say, they're so tall. You know, even something that you think would be not harmful, any comment about body shape or size is to be avoided. So that means your own body shape or size. So if you're not feeling good about how your body looks, keep that to yourself, talk to your partner, but don't share it in front of your kids.
Okay. And I mean, like you said, it is so hard. I feel like I just, like I said, I grew up dancing and a big part of that was kind of looking a certain way. Mm-hmm. And everybody talked about that. And I'm pregnant with my first, but I remember growing up, finally, I had a therapist say to me, like, what you were saying about your body, would you want your child to say that about theirs? And I was like horrified by that prospect.
Absolutely.
I didn't even have kids then, but just that idea of hearing a child say what I was saying about myself, like, really shook me.
Yeah. Yeah. If your kid is saying some negative comments about their body shape or size, I want you to ask questions. Again, I think a curious approach is really the best in these areas. So say, wow, what do you mean by that? A lot of us instantly want to be like, that's not true, or, okay, I'll help you, you know, change, eat more, you know, vegetables and fruit. I just want you to ask questions, explore, get more information, and see how their self-worth is. If they're putting a lot of their self-worth on their shape or size or their amount of activity that they do, this is another area. If you see someone young, you know, compulsively exercising, that's abnormal as well. So asking questions so that you can get more information. And then, you know, at the University of Utah, we have a great web page on both eating disorders and actually bipolar, which we were talking about earlier. Parents can go there then with some of that information and look at some of the more detailed answers we have.
Yeah, and these are, obviously, we're talking about really heavy topics. And I guess the good news is in it is that there is help. There is a way for parents and for kids to do something so they can kind of, you know, feel like themselves again and get their life back on track.
Absolutely. I think this is probably the only way that I can really talk about all these dark areas is because I see the other side all the time. I see people getting better. I see kids living their best life. I see kids recover. I see them have really awesome outcomes. So yes, this is not something they'll have to deal with for the rest of their life. In a lot of cases, you can have one episode of major depression and not have any more. You can have an anxiety disorder and it can be treated. You can have an eating disorder and not be having to have that your entire life. Again, if we can intervene early, really great outcomes.
And we mentioned at the very beginning, I'm kind of switching gears back to what we mentioned at the beginning. Let's talk, because you said there was a way to help. Let's talk about suicide, which is never an easy topic to talk about. But the truth of the matter is it has to be talked about so that we can help these kids. We can protect our kids and their friends. How can parents talk to their kids? Because this is such a difficult and hard topic. How do you begin that conversation?
That's a hard topic. So we have some guidelines written through one of our blogs at the University of Utah about how to talk to specific age groups about death by suicide. And I really want us to work to change our language. We often say committed suicide, but now really the term that is most respectful is died by suicide, because someone suffering from a brain condition that makes the feel that that's the only option. So the biggest thing to be thinking about is, what is your age, your child's physical age, and then also their development. Right. And so where are they at? So are they someone who can have more details or less details? So again, same approach, want you to ask questions. You can start off with like, hey, I read this. What do you think? Like, have you heard about this term suicide? And just ask in a very neutral way. You, by bringing it up, you're not going to suggest that idea to your child. A lot of people think, oh, if I bring up suicide, that's going to make someone know about it and then they're going to do it. The evidence says, no, that's not true. In fact, talking about suicide will prevent suicides in a big way.
Okay. So what is important for kids to know regarding this topic?
I think the most important thing is that a lot of that people die by suicide for a couple reasons when they're young. And specifically, sometimes they have a brain condition called depression, which is, you know, a medical condition that needs some medicine to feel better. But they can start to feel like death is the right answer because they feel bad. And that is a lie. That is a brain lie. Okay. The next reason is that young people, again, those big feelings, they don't have a lot of coaching yet. They don't have good life experience to tell them that they're going to get through these big feelings, that you need to teach your kids that hard feelings will pass, and jumping to death is never the right answer. Ever, ever, ever. We will always brainstorm. We can always work together. We will always get you through anything big that happens. Nothing is unrepairable. Those two messages, really important for parents to be telling their kids.
Absolutely. And I'm honestly getting really emotional talking about this because it just breaks my heart that some kids, you know, they get to this point. So if someone just, you know, has a child who is thinking about suicide, how can the parents help them?
The number one thing to do is to call in a professional. So never feel like you are alone and that you have to manage this. We want you to take every statement about suicide seriously because we don't know, you know, who is really thinking about it versus in the early stages. So bring them right away into their primary care doctor, the emergency room, urgent care, anywhere that you need to be seen if you feel like they are unsafe. There are a lot of phone resources. There's a national suicide hotline. There is an app on kids' phones. I always say make sure that the kids all have the Safe UT app. They talk about it in school. They need to download it and open up a username so that it's there. They can 24/7 text anyone that is they can text a professional and get some support. So the first thing to do, reach out. Next thing, inform yourself. So there's a lot of great information about suicide prevention out there. And we want you to have that support.
Absolutely. So speaking of support, how can we, and this is just so hard to imagine, but it does happen. How can someone support a child who may have lost a friend to suicide?
Yeah, really hard topic. Thankfully, we've come so far in our understanding of how children process death and grief, and we have very specific resources for them. So both at a school level and then at, you know, a healthcare professional, so a psychiatrist, a psychologist. You really want to talk with your child, check in frequently about how they're feeling, how they're doing, watch for changes in their behavior to see if they're, you know, doing okay, how they're eating, how they're sleeping, really comforting your child on however they feel, if they feel sad, if they feel angry, if they don't seem to be showing any feeling. Like, those are all very normal expressions and responses to grief. Everyone processes grief differently, and so one moment they might be okay, the next moment they may not be. So really supporting them where they're at, paying attention to their habits, and then definitely getting them someone to talk to if they feel like they're needing some more help than you can provide.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, even as an adult, I've discovered that grief isn't linear, and that it's the same thing with kids, especially if something like this happens to one of their friends, which it can be just so shocking for these sweet kids to have to go through this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think definitely explaining to kids that, you know, their friend likely had a brain condition, that, you know, they were ill. That's a really helpful thing to discuss too, because it wasn't that they wanted to do that. It's that they felt that was the only choice or that was the best choice.
Mm-hmm. And so before we switch gears to our final topic, I just want to repeat that although this is always going to be a heavy topic, it's always going to be one that makes people emotional, but it's important that we talk about it because, as you said, there is hope to help kids before they get to that point.
Absolutely. Always there's hope and there's help.
Yeah. And that is just something I just really wanted to reiterate that, really wanted to repeat it, because in this last question of our podcast, we're kind of switching gears to our final topic. sex can be...
I like that we're ending on this topic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit of like a mood shift, but it's also something pretty relevant.
Yeah, and I mean, I said it just a little bit right there. Sex can be another uncomfortable conversation to have with kids. Why do you think it's so important to parents that, you know what, you have to teach your kids about sex? It's uncomfortable, but you got to do it. Why is it so important?
It is so important that they're getting accurate health information. I want us to shift our brains, if we can, to think about sexual intercourse, sexuality, intimacy, and consent, which is tied to all of that, as a healthcare discussion. If you're not comfortable, get them to someone who is. I mean, get them to their primary care doctor. But basically, if you can reframe it like that and know it's uncomfortable, know it's difficult, you want your kids to have accurate information, not stuff they find on the internet, and definitely not stuff they're getting from their friends, which is likely to be wrong, fraught with misunderstanding. And it's really important that they know they can come to you and talk about anything, including sex, and maybe you're going to be uncomfortable, and that's okay too. Like, you can do uncomfortable things, you can do hard things. You know, talking to your kids about sex, intimacy, consent does not make them sexual. It helps them understand their normal feelings and their bodies. You know, sexuality for a long time has been really considered taboo in a lot of cultures. And then, you know, as people get to be adults, they're suddenly, supposed to feel really good about it. Like, this is a great thing. Why aren't you, embracing your partnership? And people are like, because my whole life I felt like it was a bad thing and I shouldn't talk about it. And I don't really actually know a lot about it. So, you know, we really want to change that. Also, you know, media, you know, TV, everything, it is everywhere, right? Sexualized and, portraying bodies that are not attainable. Like, we really want to get ahead of that.
Absolutely. And I love how you said parents can do hard, uncomfortable things, because I feel like that's something people tell kids a lot. Like, you can do hard things. And like, this can be hard for parents, but you can do the hard, uncomfortable thing to help your child out.
You really can. Yeah, it's so uncomfortable. I can tell you from my experience. I did some research and I found a really great book, and I was just so anxious when I was reading through it because it was pretty detailed and descriptive. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I want my kids to be aware of X, Y, and Z. But then I realized, like, they're going to find out. Mm-hmm. And I'd much rather it be from an accurate, reputable source.
Absolutely.
And also, a book can be a really nice thing to kind of give your child, because that way you don't have to directly explain everything. Make sure you review that book and that it's accurate. But it's just a nice distancing technique for both of you, because they're going to be embarrassed at some point. You know, they're going to have a lot of questions and they don't want to tell you everything. So it's a good option.
Absolutely. All right. You mentioned a book, but how else can parents talk to their kids about sex?
Well, I think bringing up anything you notice while you're watching TV together, that's a really helpful strategy. So you can be like, wow, that didn't seem realistic to me. Like, what did you think about that? Or, wow, that I noticed that there's a lot of talk about sex in this show. Like, it makes me wonder, like, do you know, what they're talking about? Or, hey, I overheard this conversation when your friend was over. Like, tell me what your friends know about sex. Like, bringing it on to your friends is a distancing technique also that can make both of you feel more comfortable. It's all easier to kind of do it indirectly, informally, than like, hey, tonight we're going to have the big discussion. Sit down, clearing the table after dinner. Yeah, that's going to be awkward. So small little things, and then follow your child's cues. If they're like, ew, I don't want to talk about that, gross, then that's okay too. But also watching, your own attitudes about sexuality and what you say to in front of your children. Like, if you're like, feeling about it, or you're feeling negative, really think about how that is going to impact your kids, because they're looking to you for everything.
Absolutely. Kristen, this podcast has just been, I don't know what other word to use besides treasure trove. I wish there was something else, of just these amazing advice that you've given, tips you've given, things for people to watch out for. It's just been jam-packed full of amazing information. Before we wrap up, I just want to know if there's anything that you want to mention to parents who have been listening to this, to kids that have been listening to this, that you maybe didn't mention.
you know, I just love to end on the idea of having a back and forth conversation with your kids and really asking them what they know about things, hearing their opinions, meeting your child really where they're at in their own minds instead of where maybe you want them to be, coaching your child. I think a lot of, you know, problems when I distill them down with parents and children is parents not always recognizing that maybe this could be changed in their mind as a coaching tactic, right? So instead of like as a heavy, as an authority, but like you need to coach your kid just like a coach would for a different sport. So it takes a little of the pressure off of you, and it also makes it a little bit more palatable for your kid.
Perfect. Well, Kristen, like I said, it has been so informational sitting here with you, and I loved how you gave us the facts, but you gave us hope, which is such an amazing thing to give people. Kristen, again, thank you so much for being with us, and thank you everyone who was listening today. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe, and we will catch you next time.
Congrats, you made it to the end. If you want to continue to freshen up your day, you can watch us on Fresh Living every weekday on CBS Channel 2 in Utah at 1 o'clock. You can also watch us on our YouTube channel, KUTV Fresh Living, and follow us on social media. We will see you next week.